Chapter 6. Oh yes. I attended the inquiry, apostrophe he would say, and to this day I haven't left off wondering why I went. I am willing to believe each of us has a guardian angel, if you fellows will concede to me that each of us has a familiar devil as well. I want you to own up, because I don't like to feel exceptional in any way, and I know I have him the devil, I mean. I haven't seen him, of course, but I go upon circumstantial evidence. He is there right enough, and, being malicious, he lets me in for that kind of thing. What kind of thing, you ask? Why, the inquiry thing, the yellow dog thing. You wouldn't think a mangy, native type would be allowed to trip up people in the veranda of a magistrate's court, would you? The kind of thing that by devious, unexpected, truly diabolical ways causes me to run up against men with soft spots, with hard spots, with hidden plague spots, by Jove! And loosens their tongues at the sight of me for their infernal confidences. As though, forsooth, I had no confidences to make to myself, as though, God help me, I didn't have enough confidential information about myself to harrow my own soul till the end of my appointed time. And what I have done to be thus favored I want to know. I declare I am as full of my own concerns as the next man, and I have as much memory as the average pilgrim in this valley, so you see I am not particularly fit to be a receptacle of confessions. Then why? Can't tell unless it be, to make time pass away after dinner. Charlie, my dear chap, your dinner was extremely good, and in consequence these men here look upon a quiet rubber as a tumultuous occupation. They wallow in your good chairs, and think to themselves, hang exertion. Let that Marlowe talk. Talk? So be it. And it's easy enough to talk of Master Jim, after a good spread, 200 feet above the sea level, with a box of decent cigars handy, on a blessed evening of freshness and starlight, that would make the best of us forget we are only on sufferance here, and got to pick our way in cross lights, watching every precious minute and every irremediable step, trusting we shall manage, yet to go out decently in the end, but not so sure of it after all, and with dashed little help, to expect from those we touch elbows with right and left. Of course there are men here and there to whom the whole of life is like an after-dinner hour with a cigar, easy, pleasant, empty, perhaps enlivened by some fable of strife, to be forgotten before the end is told, before the end is told, even if there happens to be any end to it. My eyes met his for the first time at that inquiry. You must know that everybody connected in any way with the sea was there, because the affair had been notorious for days, ever since that mysterious cable message came from Aden, to start us all cackling. I say mysterious, because it was so in a sense, though it contained a naked fact, about as naked and ugly as a fact can well be. The whole waterside talked of nothing else. First thing in the morning as I was dressing in my stateroom, I would hear through the bulkhead my Parsi Dubash jabbering about the Patna with the steward, while he drank a cup of tea, by favor, in the pantry. No sooner on shore I would meet some acquaintance, and the first remark would be, "Did you ever hear of anything to beat this?" And according to his kind the man would smile cynically, or look sad, or let out a swear or two. Complete strangers would accost each other familiarly, just for the sake of easing their minds on the subject. Every confounded loafer in the town came in for a harvest of drinks over this affair. You heard of it in the harbor office, at every ship broker's, at your agent's, from whites, from natives, from half-castes, from the very boatmen squatting half-naked on the stone steps as you went up, by Jove. There was some indignation, not a few jokes, and no end of discussions, as to what had become of them, you know. This went on for a couple of weeks or more, and the opinion, that whatever was mysterious in this affair would turn out to be tragic as well, began to prevail, when one fine morning, as I was standing in the shade by the steps of the harbor office, I perceived four men walking towards me along the quay. I wondered for a while where that queer lot had sprung from, and suddenly, I may say, I shouted to myself, here they are. There they were, sure enough, three of them as large as life, and one much larger of girth than any living man has a right to be, just landed with a good breakfast inside of them from an outward bound Dale Line steamer that had come in about an hour after sunrise. There could be no mistake. I spotted the jolly skipper of the Patna at the first glance. The fattest man in the whole blessed tropical belt clear round that good old earth of ours. Moreover, 9 months or so before, I had come across him in Samarang. His steamer was loading in the roads, and he was abusing the tyrannical institutions of the German Empire, and soaking himself in beer all day long and day after day in De Jong's back shop, till De Jong, who charged a guilder for every bottle without as much as the quiver of an eyelid, would beckon me aside, and, with his little leathery face all puckered up, declare confidentially, business is business, but this man, Captain, he make me very sick. Phew! I was looking at him from the shade. He was hurrying on a little in advance, and the sunlight beating on him brought out his bulk in a startling way. He made me think of a trained baby elephant walking on hind legs. He was extravagantly gorgeous to got up in a soiled sleeping suit, bright green and deep orange vertical stripes, with a pair of ragged straw slippers on his bare feet, and somebody's cast-off pith hat, very dirty and two sizes too small for him, tied up with a manila rope yarn on the top of his big head. You understand, a man like that hasn't the ghost of a chance when it comes to borrowing clothes. Very well. On he came in hot haste, without a look right or left, passed within 3 feet of me, and in the innocence of his heart, went on pelting upstairs into the harbor office to make his deposition, a report, or whatever you like to call it. It appears he addressed himself in the first instance to the principal shipping master. Archie Ruthful had just come in, and, as his story goes, was about to begin his arduous day by giving a dressing down to his chief clerk. Some of you might have known him, an obliging little Portuguese half-caste with a miserably skinny neck, and always on the hop, to get something from the shipmasters, in the way of eatables, a piece of salt pork, a bag of biscuits, a few potatoes, or what not. One voyage, I recollect, I tipped him a live sheep out of the remnant of my sea stock. Not that I wanted him to do anything for me he couldn't, you know, but because his childlike belief in the sacred right to perquisites quite touched my heart. It was so strong, as to be almost beautiful. The race, the two races rather, and the climate. However, never mind. I know where I have a friend for life. Well, Ruthful says he was giving him a severe lecture on official morality, I suppose, when he heard a kind of subdued commotion at his back, and turning his head he saw, in his own words, something round and enormous, resembling a 1600-weight sugar hogshead wrapped in striped flannelette, upended in the middle of the large floor space in the office. He declares he was so taken aback that for quite an appreciable time he did not realize the thing was alive, and sat still wondering for what purpose, and by what means, that object had been transported in front of his desk. The archway from the anteroom was crowded with punka pullers, sweepers, police peons, the coxswain and crew of the harbor steam launch, all craning their necks and almost climbing on each other's backs. Quite a riot. By that time the fellow had managed to tug and jerk his hat clear of his head, and advanced with slight bows at Ruthful, who told me the sight was so discomposing that for some time he listened, quite unable to make out what that apparition wanted. It spoke in a voice harsh and lugubrious but intrepid, and little by little it dawned upon Archie that this was a development of the Patna case. He says that, as soon as he understood who it was before him, he felt quite unwell. Archie is so sympathetic and easily upset, but pulled himself together and shouted, "Stop! I can't listen to you. You must go to the master attendant. I can't possibly listen to you. Captain Elliot is the man you want to see. This way, this way." He jumped up, ran round that long counter, pulled, shoved. The other led him, surprised but obedient at first, and only at the door of the private office some sort of animal instinct made him hang back and snort like a frightened bullock. "El, look here. What's up? Let go. Look here." Archie flung open the door without knocking. "Tea the master of the Patna, sir," he shouts. "Go in, Captain." He saw the old man lift his head from some writing so sharp that his nose nippers fell off, banged the door to, and fled to his desk, where he had some papers waiting for his signature. But he says the row that burst out in there was so awful that he couldn't collect his senses sufficiently to remember the spelling of his own name. Archie's the most sensitive shipping master in the two hemispheres. He declares he felt as though he had thrown a man to a hungry lion. No doubt the noise was great. I heard it down below, and I have every reason to believe it was heard clear across the esplanade as far as the bandstand. Old Father Elliot had a great stock of words, and could shout, and didn't mind who he shouted at either. He would have shouted at the Viceroy himself. As he used to tell me, "Colin, I am as high as I can get. My pension is safe. I've a few pounds laid by, and if they don't like my notions of duty I would just as soon go home as not. I am an old man, and I have always spoken my mind. All I care for now is to see my girls married before I die." He was a little crazy on that point. His three daughters were awfully nice, though they resembled him amazingly, and on the mornings he woke up with a gloomy view of their matrimonial prospects. The office would read it in his eye and tremble, because, they said, he was sure to have somebody for breakfast. However, that morning he did not eat the renegade, but, if I may be allowed to carry on the metaphor, chewed him up very small, so to speak, and ejected him again. Thus in a very few moments I saw his monstrous bulk descend in haste and stand still on the outer steps. He had stopped close to me for the purpose of profound meditation. His large purple cheeks quivered. He was biting his thumb, and after a while noticed me with a sidelong vexed look. The other three chaps that had landed with him made a little group waiting at some distance. There was a sallow-faced, mean little chap with his arm in a sling, and a long individual in a blue flannel coat, as dry as a chip, and no stouter than a broomstick, with drooping gray mustaches, who looked about him with an air of jaunty imbecility. The third was an upstanding, broad-shouldered youth, with his hands in his pockets, turning his back on the other two who appeared to be talking together earnestly. He stared across the empty esplanade. A ramshackle gharry, all dust and Venetian blinds, pulled up short opposite the group, and the driver, throwing up his right foot over his knee, gave himself up to the critical examination of his toes. The young chap, making no movement, not even stirring his head, just stared into the sunshine. This was my first view of Jim. He looked as unconcerned and unapproachable as only the young can look. There he stood, clean-limbed, clean-faced, firm on his feet, as promising a boy as the sun ever shone on, and, looking at him, knowing all he knew, and a little more too, I was as angry as though I had detected him trying to get something out of me by false pretenses. He had no business to look so sound. I thought to myself, well, if this sort can go wrong like that. And I felt as though I could fling down my hat and dance on it from sheer mortification, as I once saw the skipper of an Italian bark do, because his duffer of a mate got into a mess with his anchors when making a flying moor in a roadstead full of ships. I asked myself, seeing him there apparently so much at ease, is he silly? Is he callous? He seemed ready to start whistling a tune. And note, I did not care a rap about the behavior of the other two. Their person somehow fitted the tale that was public property and was going to be the subject of an official inquiry. "Tea, that old mad rogue upstairs called me a hound," said the captain of the Patna. I can't tell whether he recognized me, I rather think he did, but at any rate our glances met. He glared, I smiled. Hound was the very mildest epithet that had reached me through the open window. Did he? I said from some strange inability to hold my tongue. He nodded, bit his thumb again, swore under his breath. Then lifting his head and looking at me with sullen and passionate impudence, "Ah, the Pacific is big, my friend. You damned Englishman can do your worst. I know where there's plenty room for a man like me. I am well aguant in Apia, in Honolulu, in..." Dottie paused reflectively, while without effort I could depict to myself the sort of people he was gained with in those places. I won't make a secret of it, that I had been gained with not a few of that sort myself. There are times when a man must act as though life were equally sweet in any company. I've known such a time, and, what's more, I shan't now pretend to pull a long face over my necessity, because a good many of that bad company from want of moral what shall I say? Posture, or from some other equally profound cause, were twice as instructive and 20 times more amusing than the usual respectable thief of commerce you fellows ask to sit at your table without any real necessity from habit, from cowardice, from good nature, from a hundred sneaking and inadequate reasons. Apostrophe, you Englishmen are all rogues, went on my patriotic Flensburger Stettin Australian. I really don't recollect now what decent little port on the shores of the Baltic was defiled by being the nest of that precious bird. W, what are you to shout? Eh? You tell me? You know better than other people, and that old rogue he made goddam fuss with me. His thick carcass trembled on its legs, that were like a pair of pillars. It trembled from head to foot. See, that's what you English always make a tam fuss for any little thing, because I was not born in your tam country. Take away my certificate. Take it. I don't want the certificate. A man like me don't want your verfluched certificate. I spit on it. He spat. I will an American citizen beg him, he cried, fretting and fuming and shuffling his feet, as if to free his ankles from some invisible and mysterious grasp that would not let him get away from that spot. He made himself so warm that the top of his bullet head positively smoked. Nothing mysterious prevented me from going away. Curiosity is the most obvious of sentiments, and it held me there to see the effect of a full information upon that young fellow who, hands in pockets, and turning his back upon the sidewalk, gazed across the grass plots of the Esplanade at the yellow portico of the Malabar Hotel with the air of a man about to go for a walk, as soon as his friend is ready. That's how he looked, and it was odious. I waited to see him overwhelmed, confounded, pierced through and through, squirming like an impaled beetle, and I was half afraid to see it too, if you understand what I mean. Nothing more awful than to watch a man who has been found out, not in a crime, but in a more than criminal weakness. The commonest sort of fortitude prevents us from becoming criminals in a legal sense. It is from weakness unknown, but perhaps suspected, as in some parts of the world you suspect a deadly snake in every bush from weakness, that may lie hidden, watched, or unwatched, preyed against or manfully scorned, repressed or may be ignored more than half a lifetime. Not one of us is safe. We are snared into doing things for which we get called names, and things for which we get hanged, and yet the spirit may well survive the condemnation, survive the altar, by Jove. And there are things they look small enough sometimes too by which some of us are totally and completely undone. I watched the youngster there. I liked his appearance. I knew his appearance. He came from the right place. He was one of us. He stood there for all the parentage of his kind, for men and women by no means clever or amusing, but whose very existence is based upon honest faith, and upon the instinct of courage. I don't mean military courage, or civil courage, or any special kind of courage. I mean just that inborn ability to look temptation straight in the face, a readiness unintellectual enough, goodness knows, but without pose a power of resistance. Don't you see, ungracious if you like, but priceless and unthinking, and blessed stiffness before the outward and inward terrors, before the might of nature and the seductive corruption of men backed by a faith invulnerable to the strength of facts, to the contagion of example, to the solicitation of ideas. Hang ideas. They are tramps, vagabonds, knocking at the back door of your mind, each taking a little of your substance, each carrying away some crumb of that belief in a few simple notions you must cling to, if you want to live decently, and would like to die easy. This has nothing to do with Jim, directly. Only he was outwardly so typical of that good, stupid kind we like to feel marching right and left of us in life, of the kind that is not disturbed by the vagaries of intelligence and the perversions of nerves, let us say. He was the kind of fellow you would, on the strength of his looks, leave in charge of the deck figuratively and professionally speaking. I say I would, and I ought to know. Haven't I turned out youngsters enough in my time, for the service of the red rag, to the craft of the sea, to the craft whose whole secret could be expressed in one short sentence, and yet must be driven afresh every day into young heads till it becomes the component part of every waking thought till it is present in every dream of their young sleep. The sea has been good to me, but when I remember all these boys that passed through my hands, some grown up now, and some drowned by this time, but all good stuff for the sea, I don't think I have done badly by it either. Were I to go home tomorrow, I bet that before 2 days passed over my head some sunburnt young chief mate would overtake me at some dock gateway or other, and a fresh deep voice speaking above my hat would ask, "Colin, don't you remember me, sir? Why, little so-and-so. Such and such a ship. It was my first voyage." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.